And welcome back to Coast, Edward Gross with us. We're talking about his work. He co-wrote with Mark Altman, The 50-Year Mission. It's about Star Trek. I'm really enjoying this. Let's get your calls, too, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. If you are a fan of Star Trek, check in with us. If you just want to talk about science, check in with us as well. Edward Gross with us. This is fun. You must have had fun doing all of this, Edward.
Oh, I mean, believe me, we had a ball doing it. You know, it was very funny because every time Mark and I would get, well, one of us would get a new interview, we'd call the other up and say, hey, I just spoke to so-and-so. Oh, yeah, well, I just spoke to so-and-so. And it became this massive competition in a very good way between us because we were just watching the pieces fall together. And it was just great joy watching that happen.
Did you ever expect that in your career you would be aligned with Star Trek?
You know, when I started writing, you know, professionally, and I first became a journalist, somebody paid me for my writing. The first thing I wanted to do was write about the things I always loved. So it started off like I did some articles for Starlog and ended up doing a lot of articles for Starlog magazine, chronicling the original series, talking to directors and writers from that show, many of who, you know, unfortunately aren't with us anymore. So I kind of aligned myself with the things I loved, whether it was Star Trek or the Beatles or Superman or any of the things I loved as a kid I was fortunate enough to write about. But Star Trek just took on a life of its own with me in the sense of once I started covering it, I never stopped. I mean, like I told you earlier, I spoke to Anton Yelchin, you know, 2 weeks ago. So right to this day, for the last 35 years, Star Trek has been a very important part of this. But this book is the culmination, I think, of all of that.
Okay, let's go to the calls. Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Bill, you're up.
Yes, hi, George. Hi. Yes, hi, hi. I have an interesting speculative idea, I want to say, to your guests. It involves NASA, the Real Life Space Program, and history, an alternative history. I'll explain. It relates to how right now in real life in 2016, we could be just a little bit more like Star Trek, not to the level of Star Trek was in the movie, of course, but a little much more advanced than we are. I'll explain. It involves an alternative history. I'll explain what I mean. My point is, it involves the horrible assassination of Bobby Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, in 1968. My point is, Richard Nixon came so close to beating... Richard Nixon beat Hubert Humphrey very closely. Hubert Humphrey came so close to winning. If Bobby Kennedy had run in 68, he would have beaten Richard Nixon. Now it relates to space in that Richard Nixon canceled the Apollo program as of 1971, and Apollo ended December 1972 with Apollo 17. So my point is, in an alternative universe, you could say, if Bobby Kennedy had been in the presidency for 8 years, two full terms, till January 1977, he would undoubtedly have expanded on and increased what his brother, President John F. Kennedy, initiated in the early 1960s, the Apollo program. So the point that I'm trying to say is Apollo would have continued another 8 more years and beyond into the early 1980s. We never would have had the space shuttle, which I think was in many ways a waste for 3 decades, 30 years, 1981 to 2011. We would have expanded on going to the moon so that by now, 2016, we would not only have a lunar base with maybe 50 or more people on the south pole of the moon, but 2 years from now in 2018, which is the best launch window in decades to go to Mars, we would be preparing to go for the first humans to Mars in just 2 years. This all possibly could have happened had Robert Kennedy been president after Lyndon Johnson and before him John F. Kennedy. What would your guest comment?
Well, there you go. Ed, you want to?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, you know, alternate history is fascinating. It, you know, would we have had the money to do all that stuff? I don't know. It's an intriguing idea, and anything that would move us closer to a little more world unity, I think, would have been a wonderful thing, especially now when you consider that we're so far apart, people are around the world. So I don't know. I mean, it's an intriguing idea. Whether or not that could have come about, that is, like you said, it's a speculative thought, but it's a good one. It's something we should aspire towards, you know, expanding out there.
We go east of the Rockies. Remy in New Jersey is up with us now on Coast to Coast. Hi, Remy.
Hey, George. How are you?
Good. Good to have you back.
Thank you. I'm glad you remember me.
Oh, yeah. You've got a different name.
Yes, I do. No, I just want to make a comment your guest made a little while ago about the new series that was going to come out. Every, you know, few months, I always take a look and, you know, because I love Star Trek. I am really into the first one. Really didn't get into Star Trek until about, like, 10 years ago. I'm 28 now. But, you know, once I finished binge-watching all the series, I start, you know, every once in a while I look back and, you know, are they going to, you know, bring it back on TV? And when I heard that they were going to do this new one, I was so excited until I started looking it up and I found out that, like, yeah, it's going to come out. But the problem is the way they're going to do it, it doesn't look like it's going to be through, like, actual television. You're going to have to do it through, I can't remember which network was going to pick it up, but you have to do it through their streaming service or something. And you have to pay, like, extra money to see it. And I'm so disappointed because I'd love to see it, but I pay so much money for, you know, TV already and then Netflix and, you know, all those other things. I just wish it was going to be in a more accessible place so that it could get better ratings when it does eventually come out, because I don't think I'll be able to see it. And I just wanted to know what your guests thought about that.
Well, they're putting it on CBS All Access, which is, you know, CBS's streaming service. The way I look at it is that, yeah, it would be nice if it was on broadcast television. But the problem with broadcast television, if it doesn't get the ratings that they want,
it's gone.
They're going to cancel it.
Yeah.
They're going to cancel it. And, I mean, it's Star Trek, so it'd probably get a first season. But if the ratings aren't what they're expecting, it's a very expensive show to produce, they're going to cancel it.
And nowadays, Ed, don't you get like 8 episodes? That's it?
Oh, if you're lucky, if you get 8. I mean, a lot of times shows are canceled after 2 or 3. Now, this is Star Trek, so obviously they wait a little longer because it's such an investment to do. But the way I look at it is like, okay, if I'm paying $5 or $6 a month for CBS All Access, and I know that for 13 weeks I'm getting, you know, an hour of Star Trek, brand new Star Trek, commercial free, that's not such a bad trade-off, I think. I mean, I pay, you know, a movie $10, $20 by the time we go to the movies, $30 even with popcorn. But, you know, to me, that's not a bad rate to get a quality Star Trek show that isn't concerned about ratings. They're concerned about subscribers, but not ratings. And I think that's a big difference.
Well, it's a huge difference.
Yeah.
It really is. When you were writing the book, did you come across any difficulties getting information or people, actors, who didn't want to talk to you, or was everybody forthcoming?
Well, I mean, you know, actors are always the toughest ones to get, you know, but I find that the truth is the best stories come from those behind-the-scenes people, you know, the writers, the directors, you know, the people who are in the trenches making this show. And what I was thrilled about is that when we went back, to, you know, we had, Mark Altman and I had cultivated a lot of relationships with these people over the decades, basically. So when we called them up and said, hey, we're doing this oral history, you know, are you willing to talk to us again for this? What was amazing is people like Ron Moore and Ira Bear, you know, Ron Moore is now doing Outlander, and he had done Battlestar Galactica. Ira Bear, who works on Outlander, but, you know, guided Deep Space Nine. Brandon Braga, who's doing Salem now. All these guys said yes. They got on the phone with us, and they spent, if we put it all together, probably 6-7 hours each reflecting on Star Trek, and they all had the same attitude. If we're going to do this, let's do this right. And I can't tell you how gratifying that was.
Next up, we go to Scott in North Carolina. Scott, go ahead. Take it away.
Hey, how are you guys doing tonight?
Good, Scott. Thank you.
I wanted to explore with you some of the other, like, some of the fan-made creations out there. You know, you've got the Farragut and stuff like that over on YouTube. But the one that I really would be most interested in and seeing the studio pick up and run with was Axanar. And it's a shame is what has happened to that so far, because the parts that they have been able to film, they had some top-notch actors and everything in there, and it would have been great to see that story told and help expound the whole total Star Trek story.
That would be interesting, Ed.
Yeah, well, look, I was very impressed with what they did in Axanar. I really was. And I'm not going to pretend to know all the details behind, you know, what went on and triggered the lawsuit from Paramount and CBS. But it seems to me that it was a project that raised a lot of money with Kickstarter, was selling merchandise or giving merchandise away with Star Trek, you know, insignias or trademarked images. And they kind of built a warehouse, from what I understand, or a film studio that they were going to use for other films outside of this fan film. So it seemed like it crossed the line where a lot of the other fan films hadn't. Creatively, I think it looks great, and I would love to see it finished, but they kind of pushed it over the line, it seems, at least from my version, you know, what I've seen of it. And they kind of forced Paramount's hand to take an action. Otherwise, anybody could go out and say, well, I'm going to do this too, because they called it an independent Star Trek film. And maybe they shouldn't have.
Edward, besides Gene Roddenberry, who do you think was the focal point, the creative force behind the success of Star Trek? Was it a TV executive somewhere? Was it somebody on the show? Who was it?
I would say that probably next to Roddenberry, the most important part in the original Star Trek's history has to be Gene L. Coon, who was the producer that came in the middle of the first season and stayed to the middle of the second season. And if you look at the quality of the shows in that period, it's Star Trek's golden age. I mean, those are the best episodes produced in that period. Gene Coon had an ability to take, you know, Roddenberry's vision, which, you know, nobody could take away Gene Roddenberry's vision for having created this show. But Gene Coon was able to take it and hone in on what worked. He's the guy who decided the show was about Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. He came up with the prime directive. He introduced the Klingons. He put on the allegories much more. I mean, they did Vietnam allegories and race allegories that the show hadn't done before that. So he was really the guy. And, you know, we had the fortune of speaking to his assistant, Andre Richardson, a African-American woman at the time. Well, still at the time, though. Who was friends with Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. And she told us that she considered Gene Coon to be in their level of as a human, as a person, that she considered him to be on their level, which says a lot about Gene Coon. Gene Coon was a writer through and through.
But died early, too, didn't he?
He died in 72 of lung cancer, unfortunately.
Oh.
And it was very, very quick. I mean, we spoke to a lot of people who knew Gene, his wife at the time, and they said that he was just a workaholic. Like, he would sit down at that typewriter of his and just pound out the pages like nobody had ever seen before. And all of a sudden, he just wasn't feeling well. He went to the doctor, and I think it was 2 or 3 weeks later, he died of lung cancer.
Oh, sad.
It is, because his contribution is immeasurable to Star Trek.
Let's go to Shaheen in Austin, Texas. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Gentlemen, for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Wonderful, and he's underestimating his contribution to the world. And I'm not being silly, but the producer and I were talking, and the whole concept of Star Trek actually coming in and changing the fulcrum or pointing the needle in a new direction, changing the premise. That's what the world's a calculus. Human beings want to grow and become more educated. That's sort of in their nature. And I was laughing with the producer. If there really is an Illuminati that's trying to dumb down people, they need special needs training, because the human nature is not like that. They love learning and growing and all of that, and not being trapped in a world where everything's about them. I define what I do every day in terms of how it helps me. That's like infantile. To actually get to a level where you would think through a program like that and then engage people and make them think like that, I think it's astounding. And I just wanted to call and compliment you, that's all.
Well, there you go, Ed. You deserve it.
Oh, me? Okay.
Stand up. Take a bow.
All right, I will. No, it's that's what I've always loved about Star Trek, though. It's just presented us a better version of us. You know, it really is a vision that is worth aspiring towards. And we're still so far away from as a people, but definitely worth aspiring towards.
Yeah, sure is. Let's take a few more calls and a break, and then we'll come back with final calls for you. Jeff in Juneau, Alaska. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Hey, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Hey, Edward, I just wanted to ask you what you think about a couple of things here. In the original series, they capitalized on that second show, on the second movie, by resurrecting the episode with Khan in it. But I wanted to get your opinion about, you know, they also had this character in the original series named Trelane, if you remember him.
Oh, yeah.
And that, do you think that is what caused them to make the Q happen in the Next Generation? And they even had an episode of the Next Generation where Trelane comes and Picard laughs because he becomes the pest for Q, you know, or something. like that. And they also brought like the Borg. And do you think that they are going to like tap these different character lines for new movies?
You know, I don't know. Let me answer the first thing about Trilene and Q. When Gene added that bit, it was a wraparound around Dorothy Fontana's script for Encounter at Farpoint, and he added the Q thing, and everyone was like, this is Trilene. Why are we doing this again? It's the same thing. But what's interesting is John DeLancey came in and was so fantastic as Q that he made it his own part. You know, it was like he made Q a phenomenal supporting character, a recurring character on Star Trek The Next Generation, that I don't think it would have in lesser hands than his. So he really took what was a Trilene, you know, retread and turned it into a unique thing, which is, you know, compliments to him. As far as the new show, I really honestly believe, like, Star Trek Into Darkness did the whole Khan thing again and reversed, you know, Wrath of Khan in certain ways and that sort of thing. And I'm not sure that was entirely satisfying. It was interesting seeing Khan again. The new show, I have a feeling, is, well, it's set in that universe, initially anyway, is not going to be revisiting old storylines. I think they feel they have to go forward. They have to create new things, new situations, new characters, and have a new crew or whatever the setup is, because I still don't even know what the setup is of the show, encounter new things rather than like, hey, remember in episode 62 of the original series? You know, that sort of thing.
What was this situation with the Klingons and their language? Because I remember people trying to speak that all over the place. What was that?
Well, you know what? It started in the Star Trek The Motion Picture. They introduced in the opening scene, there's the Klingons who look very different than they did on the TV show, because they had the money to actually do it, started speaking their own language. And it grew from there. If you watch those Star Trek films, and then on Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, they really created a language. You know, Big Bang Theory makes fun of it all the time, or you know, has fun with it, I should say.
Can you speak it?
They actually created a language.
Can you speak it?
No. No. I do not have the time to invest in learning a language that is not a real language, so I can't do it.
Let's go to Rick in Warsaw, Indiana. Hey, Rick, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering, what if Star Trek, since it's placed so far in the future, that the technology that they're using becomes outdated by then?
Well, that's an interesting take, but they kind of stayed on the cutting edge of technology, Ed, haven't they?
Well, certainly. I mean, look, you look back at that original show, the stuff that Gene Roddenberry and those people envisioned, it's astounding how much of it came true. You know, I mean, the communicators with the flip phones, you know, before the iPhone, the pads on Next Generation became tablets. You know, it's just so much of the stuff they envisioned, the sick bay. Supposedly, you know, the Navy, I think, took a tour of the Enterprise sick bay set and wondered how they had seen these plans for the future that they were intending on sick bay. So it's amazing how far ahead they always were, it seems. That was a very important part of the show, to create that sense of realism by tapping into sort of what's happening now and extrapolating on it. And they obviously knew what they were talking about.
Well, they sure did. And we're going to come back in a moment and take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM before we start open lines. So here we go. Well, I hope you all have a great Independence weekend, of course, celebrating our nation's birthday. We'll have live programs for you all weekend long. I'll be on Sunday night, by the way, Dave Schrader tomorrow. And then I'll be on live Monday night. It'll be Independence Day at night. Fireworks galore. We'll have a live program for you. And welcome back to our final segment with Edward Gross as we're talking about the work that he did with Mark Altman, the 50-year mission, the first 25 years. You want to say hi to Mark? I'm sure he's listening, Ed, somewhere, huh?
Mark, where are you?
Where are you, Mark?
Where are you, Mark?
How long have you two collaborated on works?
We started, what happened was we were covering Star Trek separately. You know, he was writing for his own magazine, Galactic Journal, and then he went on to Cine Fantastique. I was with Starlog and a few others, and one time we just contacted each other. I think I reached out to him, and I just said to him, hey, you know, you're doing this, I'm doing this, why don't we pool our stuff together? So we've done this sort of thing before, and when the 50th anniversary was coming up, it just seemed like the perfect opportunity to sort of deliver what we feel is our final word on the subject. I mean, we'll still be writing on it, but you know what I mean. It's sort of a culmination of everything that we've done separately and together.
What is it about TV cults that people latch onto? to the point where in the Star Trek situation, you know, you've got conventions and you've got everything. Why do people grab onto things like that?
You know, the old thing, like soap opera actors used to deal with the fact that people felt like they knew them, right? Because they were coming into their home every day.
Every day.
So, you know, they felt like, oh, this is my friend. I see him every day in my living room. I think these shows, and especially something like Star Trek, creates a sense of unity between people who, and the history has shown that there are a lot of people who are feeling very isolated and alone, who through the Star Trek conventions connected with other people, discovered that there are other people like them into the same thing that they were into. And it created a bond, and a bond that's, you know, been lasting for decades.
Yeah, it really has. Yeah. Let's go to our first-time caller, Kevin, in Anaheim, California now. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, George. Hi, Ed.
Hey, how are you?
To ask you about Borden, the first movie, Planet of Titans.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen some drawings by Ralph McQuarrie and Ken Adam, and, gee, it looked like it would have really been a good movie.
You know, it would have been, I mean, it's very possibly could have been, because Philip Kaufman definitely had a heavy sci-fi vision for that film. The problem was that there was a dilemma between Kaufman, producer Gerald Eisenberg, and Gene Roddenberry. Gene wanted Star Trek to stay Star Trek, and both Gerald Eisenberg and Philip Kaufman felt that Star Trek needed to move forward. And in a way, that saying that Spock to them was the most interesting character. So this was going to be a very, very heavy Spock movie if it had been made. And Kirk would have had a very minor role in it, if at all. Initially, Kirk wasn't even going to be in it. So it changed, it evolved, they brought Kirk more into it, but it really was a Spock movie. And I'm not sure the audience would have gone for it, at least the Star Trek audience would have gone for it. They were viewing it as a one-off, not a franchise.
I am amazed at how many listeners know the names of people behind the scenes, Ed.
It's one of those shows where it's like, yeah, you take it so seriously, and I mean that in a good way, that you do, you recognize every time there's a news fact out there. I mean, I remember back in the 70s when Starlog magazine would publish these little snippets of, like, they're doing a Star Trek Phase 2 TV series in the 70s was the intent before it became Star Trek the movie. So all these names that would be associated with Phase 2, well, our, you know, our associate producer did this, and this person, the executive producer, did that. So suddenly, for me, but I think it's true, it's like you know those names. So when I started writing, the first major Star Trek thing I ever did was on Star Trek Phase 2. And suddenly I'm reaching out to these people who I feel like, you know, again, the soap opera thing, I know, because I've been reading about them in Starlog every month. You know, so, you know, luckily they were all very nice. So I just find it interesting that these shows, it's like Chris Carter with The X-Files or Joss Whedon with Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
That's right. That's,
you know,
right.
they just transcend a show. They become as big a personality or star as any of the people in front of the camera.
Let's go to Peter in Asheville, North Carolina now. Peter, welcome. You're on with Edward Gross.
Hey, how are you?
Good, Pete.
Hey, yeah, I was wondering why, you know, considering the Brexit recently and things like this, and globalism now is a topic, but there isn't more discussion about the Prime Directive, you know, because it seems like, well, you mind if I get philosophical for a moment?
Go ahead, as long as it's related to what we're talking about here.
It is not. Okay. From Plato to John Locke, there used to be an idea about abstract ideas, universal ideas, and then George Berkeley did a critique of that saying, all ideas are particular. In other words, there really is no universal triangle that somehow is all triangles and no particular triangle at any one time. Every triangle is always particular. So in other words, you can't have a global culture that somehow all cultures at once and no particular culture at one time. All cultures are particular. You see what I'm saying?
Well, that's true, but bring it home a little bit, Peter, here, specifically with Star Trek. Tie it in.
There's one idea of diversity of globalism where you just mash everybody together into kind of some system. Or the other is you respect everybody's different, you know, culture and uniqueness. And I think that what the Brexit thing is, more people want to work together in a federation, perhaps, but, you know, keep their uniqueness and distinctness, rather than just matching some anonymous corporate system.
Well, I would say that in Star Trek, especially the original series, and Ed, you back me up here, yeah, that Gene Roddenberry mixed in everything. It was kind of like All in the Family, you know, just making historical moves, as you said, having, you know, blacks working with whites, working with Asians. He had it all.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I don't think, you know, I never got the impression in Star Trek that they were sort of destroying individuality of culture and society. In fact, I think they were preserving it. The whole idea was that I felt was, despite the differences, there was a unity on Earth and then in space, basically, as much as they could do. So I never felt it was squashing any, you know, individual culture or that sort of thing. I thought it was embracing all the cultures and giving each one the same respect as the other.
We have Dave in Lansing, Michigan, home of the Michigan State Spartans. Hey, David, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I am been really excited about this topic.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, Star Trek was one of those things that I think it just changed people, you know, intimately, just deeply, all the way around the world. And I think it's really cool. One of the things that bothered me, though, is I really liked Star Trek Voyager. And that one didn't seem to be one of the more popular of the series, but I liked it because it did much more of a character study, and it kind of pushed two different groups together into one ship. And they did a lot with the Borg, and I loved the Borg. It was just really cool, the whole thing. Roddenberry was a genius, I think.
Yeah.
I think he was a visionary. I think he was just a humanitarian. And I just think that that was just really, really cool. I forgot to say something what I was going to say.
All right. All right. Thank you. Ed, did this program make Roddenberry a lot of money?
No. This program did not make anybody a lot of money except for Paramount. And that's not me saying, ooh, the evil studio system. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that back then, the residual contracts that everybody had.
Oh, they're not like they are now. That's for
no,
sure.
No, you would get you would get paid for, I think it was 3 reruns of an episode. You would get something. Now, Star Trek is stripped around the country every night, running 5 nights a week.
Somewhere.
Somewhere, and back then especially, it was on like 6 o'clock in most places around the country. So those actors never made any money. You know, Gene Roddenberry was struggling to pay his mortgage. You know, he was doing college lecture, a series of college lectures. He was doing conventions. You know, William Shatner was doing Promise Margarine commercials long before Priceline.
Yeah, that's right. Making a fortune. He's probably making more on Priceline than he did with Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, once the movies kicked in, then that changed things for them, especially Shatner, Nimoy, and I guess Kelly to some degree, and
yeah.
Roddenberry. But during the 70s, it was these guys, the thing about this is Star Trek so typecast them that they couldn't get work outside of Star Trek, yet they couldn't make money from Star Trek.
That's right. That's a good point. And they probably, most people, probably worked for scale, SAG scale.
Oh, probably. I mean, most of those actors went on and did some very minor guest starring roles on TV. And you know, Nimoy busted his butt to do things, to do films, to do stage plays, to do books of poetry. I mean, you know, and Shatner did too. He did anything he could just to stay alive.
Before Star Trek, what was Shatner doing? I mean, I know he did a Twilight Zone episode, a couple of them.
But Shatner was getting Shatner in 1965 for the pilot, Where No Man Has Gone Before, the second Star Trek pilot, was considered a real coup, because this is a guy who was highly respected. He had done Broadway, he had done films, he had done TV, like you said, the Twilight Zone and other TV. So they were really excited to have him. This was not like, and for Shatner, it was like he had to really consider whether he wanted to do a TV show. Because he was, a respected, in-demand actor at the time.
Let's go to Shell in Hayward, California now. Hello, Shell.
Hi, thank you.
You sure thing.
There was 3 themes I wanted to touch on, 6 episodes, kind of get my gist of Star Trek and Roddenberry. One was the Troglodytes and the Stratus Dwellers, kind of matched with Vol. And the people would march when the drum would go to the mountain that was a computer. The Enterprise freed those people. And there was the Trouble with Tribbles.
Oh, that was
the,
great.
the one with the Hordas, where they were eating rock. and Spock did the mind meld with the Mother Horda. And then one was with Vic Tayback. He played Rocco. a gangster when they landed on the planet.
Yeah, piece of the action.
And, yeah. And the other one was with, Joan Collins.
Oh, Lady in the Witcher Forever, yeah.
Wow, she was in that.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Those six, they stuck in my mind.
You like Star Trek, Ed. I mean, like Twilight Zone, did Star Trek bring in emerging stars that went off to do big things later?
You know, there was, if you look at those shows, there are a lot of recognizable faces. You know, a lot of people who were very respected but doing the guest starring thing on a lot of TV shows at the time. I don't think anybody that nobody comes to mind. You know, Ricardo Montalban played Khan. I mean, you know, he's in a class all by himself.
That's right.
You know, but I
resurrected his career in that one, didn't he?
Say it again, I'm sorry.
He resurrected his career in that part.
Well, it was a part. It on the TV show, it was just another guest starring appearance as far as anybody was concerned. But the fact that he came back 15 years later in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, that elevated him, I think, and Star Trek. Just like, here's this little TV show from 1967, and then here we flash forward 15 years, and suddenly you've got a big budget movie in which this seemingly obscure character is now the main threat.
And, of course, Ricardo did well in Fantasy Island, right?
Of course. Yeah, that was his big thing. Yep. In fact, it was very funny when I spoke to him about playing Khan. He said his biggest problem was every time he would start speaking the words out loud, he sounded like Mr. Rourke from Fantasy Island and not Khan. So he had to do it like six or seven times and watch the episode and get back into the mindset of who Khan was.
Let's go to Ontario, Canada. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi, Gord.
Hi.
And to your guest.
Uh-huh.
I remember my father and I were right into this, but for my father to be, not too many things interested him. He just worked. But I remember I got my mother to sit down one time and watch it, too. And they said, you see all these little gadgets, like the phaser and the card that he'd stick in the computer and that. I said, at one time, or one day, that little card, that's where your music is going to come from. You're going to have these phasers. And
we're getting there. It's like the Jetsons all over again.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They had everything. You know, like there's so many things you can take from that show, and they have now.
Who would think of those things, Ed? These futurists who would be able to predict what the future would be in terms of gizmos and technology.
Well, Gene Roddenberry made a point of speaking to these people, of speaking to people in different fields to get a sense of what was coming, what was on the horizon. And then again, as I had said earlier, extrapolating on that for Star Trek and giving it that futuristic slant. But he was somebody who was really dedicated to making sure that this thing was real, that the science for the most part was real, aboard that Enterprise, that there was some logic to everything that they used. I mean, you know, Russia's now talking about, you know, I've been reading articles about Russia supposedly talking about hoping to get a transporter online, at some point in the next few years. So it's just amazing. He really, I have to give him credit for envisioning something that has taken hold in so many ways in the real world.
Will we ever get warp speed?
I don't know about that.
Would be nice.
Faster than light speed.
L.A. to New York in 20 seconds or something like that.
Well, that'd be nice. We just use a transporter. It'd be a lot easier, wouldn't it?
That's right. Just my luck for something to go wrong.
Yep. Yeah, I'll have my molecules scrambled with somebody else's.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's go to Justin in Tustin, Oklahoma. Hey, Justin, go ahead. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, listen, I just wanted to think about or pay my condolences to Anton Yelchin. He was a great actor. He played his part perfectly, just like the rest of the actors did in the new movie.
He did.
And it's just a tragedy to hear about him.
Horrible.
You know, I hope Chrysler can get their stuff together and get that recall taken care of, and I'm sure they will. But that's what my thoughts are going to, and I've been thinking about for days now.
Well said,
and, and I remember you, George. He played his part. Anton also played his part just as good as Walter Cohen did. And I remember you did an interview with him a long time ago, probably 10 years ago. He told you to read between the lines because you didn't want to make a comment about William Shatner.
His relationship. That's right. Exactly.
Yeah, that was a good interview. But at any rate, I'm a big Trekker, and I have, since the first day I read that report about him, passing away, Anton Yelchin. It just
it's horrible story. I mean, so bizarre. My God. But thanks, Justin. Appreciate it. I mean, what are the odds, Ed, of your car backing up, going down the driveway where you are and you're pinned? He probably didn't even see it coming.
No, I'm sure. I mean, they said his, you know, it lasted about less than a minute. I mean, what, you know, what happened to him before he passed.
Freak accident.
Totally freaked out. I don't know. There's probably not time left on the show, George, for this, but I have a quote from him that
I got. I've got 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Forget it. That quote ain't going to be read.
Okay, it's that long, huh?
But it's a really insightful quote about Star Trek's place in the world today. But
well, paraphrase it.
Well, here, I'll sum it up at the end. How about that? He says, oh, man. Sorry about that. He goes, we live in a world that is seemingly trying to implode and finding as many reasons not to see eye to eye as possible. Until we resolve that, and who knows when that will be or how to do that, Gene Roddenberry's message will always be relevant. It's about discovering what connects people and how to connect. It's not how to destroy one another, but how to try and figure out how to live together. That's an ancient quest that, given socioeconomics and sociopolitics, has gotten more and more convoluted. We seem to be infinitely unified in our technology and infinitely disparate in our ability to see eye to eye.
I love it. Ed, thanks for being on the show. Let us know when the second volume's done, okay?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, George.
All right. The name of the book, The 50-Year Mission, all about Star Trek. That was fun. Now we have a couple hours to go. Open lines on Coast to Coast, including whacked out people. Where have you seen them? In the store? On the streets? There was a guy running around New York yesterday, naked. Share your stories with us. That's next.